Shotcast, stargazing in more ways than one, with Jen Gupta, Evan Keane, Tim O'Brien, Mark Perver, and Chris Tibbs. The Jodcast, January 2011 Extra Edition. Hello and welcome to the Jodcast. I'm Jen Gupta and joining me today are lots of people. Hi guys.
Hello.
I don't know if you want to introduce yourselves.
Hi, I'm Evan.
I'm Mark, I've been on it before.
Hi, and I'm Chris.
Chris has been in the background and Evan is making his Jodcast debut. Yay! Woo. So, this is a rather exciting episode for us. Most people will know, especially listeners in the UK, that at the beginning of January, the BBC did a programme called Stargazing Live, which was broadcast from Jodrell Bank. It was very exciting. There was 3 nights of live astronomy presented by Brian Cox and Dara O'Brien, and even Tim O'Brien was on 2 of the shows. So that was really exciting. And we actually got to go down to Jodrell and have a nosy round, which was really cool. And while we were there, we managed to talk to some of the people, which was awesome. We were really giddy.
That
and it was amazing.
Very exciting and quite unexpected until about a day before it actually happened.
Yeah, we were banned from Jodrell Bank, which is weird because we work there.
Yeah, and because they obviously took Stargazing Live from Jodcast Live, presumably.
Yeah, well, wasn't quite up to scratch, was it?
They hadn't done it before, to be fair to them.
So hopefully we've got some new listeners because of Stargazing Live. So if you're a new listener, hello. So if you don't quite understand what's going on, the Jodcast is a monthly, but as often as possible, twice monthly podcast that we put out from here at the Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics with help from people all over the world. And we tell you what's in the night sky. We have the latest astronomy news. We answer your questions. We have interviews with current researchers. So hopefully you'll stick around and you won't get too confused what's going on. I mean, we're confused enough as it is, aren't we?
Especially this time with this kind of celebrity edition.
Yeah. So as I said, we got to go to BBC Stargazing Live and have a look around. And quite a lot of the topics on that show are things that were covered by the Jodcast. So if you want to know more about some of those topics, we can tell you about a few shows to go and check out. Tim mentioned pulsars on the show, and Mark, there's quite a few. That's your area of expertise, so I'm going to assume you know which shows to talk about.
Yes, it is. It's Evans too. There was an introduction, sort of basic intro to pulsars in July 2010 Extra, which was me, and then the most recent thing about pulsars was in the last episode, January 2011.
We've also done a few video episodes, so if you want a bit more of a tour around Jodrell Bank, there's a video episode we did in 2009. Whew, there's all the plugging out of the way. So
that doesn't mean you shouldn't also go and check out the archive. We have lots of great shows out there as well.
100, this makes it 102.
Yay.
So in the show this time, we talked to Professor Brian Cox about the link between particle physics and astrophysics. And we talked to Mark Thompson about the joys of stargazing. Tim O'Brien also is answering your questions. But before all of that, and I can't believe I'm saying this, here's comedian Dara O'Brien to tell us his views on stargazing.
Okay, I'm here today at Jodrell Bank Observatory, and I'm honoured to have with me a stand-up comedian.
Yes.
Who is also a TV presenter.
Yes.
A celebrity tweeter.
Yeah.
But above all else, he's Irish, and he's an amateur astronomer. Very welcome, Dara O'Brien.
A pleasure to be here, actually, yes. Yeah, although my amateur astronomy is probably not as strong as, you know, I did physics, and I did, but I did theoretical physics. I did mathematics and mathematical physics. So actually, I haven't looked into an eyepiece anywhere near as much as, you know, I've been letting on. You know, I'm about dusty rooms and chalkboards. Like, you know, we were in Brian's dressing room working at the Taylor series expansion to derive E equals MC squared. That's my world, my lads. It's actually this stuff where you measure things, actually look at real things. I never did that nonsense. That's ludicrous.
That's still pretty hardcore. I'm pretty impressed.
It was hardcore in itself, like whatever. And I wasn't the integration master or anything. I was all right at it. But I'm as much maths as I am physics, to be honest, whatever. Although obviously, you know, we all know this. You know, listen, I can talk sheep farmer and cattle farmer distinctions with you guys because you know what I mean. To the public, that just means they all mean the same thing. So,
well. That brings me on to my first question, actually. So you have a degree in physics, mathematical physics.
Yes. Yeah.
Can you tell me what originally interested you in doing science.
Oh, listen, being told about as a 14-year-old about relativity, being and then reading, you know, Schrodinger's cat and those kind of popularizations that catch you when you're most impressionable. And then I just, you know, that was a passion that led almost all the way through the degree, where suddenly it became all about learning different forms of Fourier transform and different forms of constitutive equations. And there was very little actual physics in a maths physics degree, and it kind of beat it out of me a little bit for a while. But it was just, you know, that childhood passion for rubber sheet geometry.
So at some stage then during your physics degree, you thought it would be more prudent to take up a more secure
career. To run away to the circus. Yes, I was in university. I was kind of an inter-varsity debater. I did, I spoke I won an Irish national title in your old university, in the Siobhan McKenna, isn't that the big theatre in Galway?
Yes.
I won the Irish Times there. And got involved in that, and that is basically you're jumping into it. That is standing in front of crowds, telling jokes, and then I ended up being the guy in UCD, which is Ireland's largest university, who would host the fresher orientation meetings,
right.
And that kind of stuff. I was the go-to guy for public talking in university, and then just weirdly somebody asked me to try, because I was one of your funny debater. So somebody said, would you try doing it a stand-up? Never really thinking that I would end up doing it like I have. I'm still waiting to be found out to a certain extent, and for somebody to call me back to the small provincial college where I'm teaching differentiation to first year engineering students.
Well, you're getting away with it quite well, I think.
Yes, I am. I am continuing to get away with it, but still that call might come, and I will have to, you know, and I look forward to going DYDX to learn to people who don't see why they have to learn it, and me going, oh,
So you started off as a scientist, and you decided to become a stand-up comedian, but you obviously remained still curious and interested in science.
I did. I would say there was a few years where I kind of, a post-degree, where I went, oh God, that was so unbelievably tough, I needed a break from it. And what happened was it re-emerged, my innate nerdiness re-emerged as I got a little bit older, and I got back in touch with it. It also re-emerged because I found myself doing a lot of kind of what we call bad science, debunking type routines, and I found myself getting very involved with that. Like every show I've done for the last while, it started with Gillian McKeith. It can all be tracked back to Gillian McKeith,
yes, okay.
And You Are What You Eat, and a show called Honey, We're Killing the Kids.
That was it.
And it had this ludicrous thing where they would show people a computer simulation, which they would say, this is an accurate prediction. You're going to, how do you know it's an accurate prediction of what the child would look like at 40? By definition, you can't say it's an accurate prediction because it's a prediction.
Yeah.
It would show a computer simulation, and then they would try to scare parents by going this, and your child would look junky, basically.
Right.
It was like, your child would look like a fat heroin junkie, if there's such a thing. And that just got me. Do you know what that got me? The male child would be shown bald, and that just infuriated me, because the parents, neither of whom were bald,
right,
would never question how are we changing our child's innate DNA. How are we giving our child male pattern baldness by feeding him pizza? And that kind of stuff just reawakened an anger in me about this kind of stuff. And it's evolved to the point where I'm doing routines about neutrinos, for Christ's sake, and bad science involving subatomic particles, and trying to get that past mainstream audiences. So my return to science was tempered not just by wonder, but by anger.
Okay, so you returned to science in an effort to defend it and...
Essentially, yeah, and there is a zeitgeisty move towards, you know, these kind of the godless shows, as we call them, which are these kind of shows where comedians share a bill with Dawkins and Cox and Ben Goldick and Simon Singh and these people, and we do our skeptical material and they do their actual science.
Okay.
And there is also, I think, a general movement among a large chunk of the population, you'll see basically all of Twitter, away from the kind of just the frothy nonsense that we've been fed for the last while, into, you know, hey, let's hear what the smart people have to say. And I am one of those sitting on the side. I happily listen to the smart people.
Hear, hear.
Yes, yeah, yeah. No, it's great. People have actually studied something. It's kind of refreshing to hear people who know something about something.
Yes. So now we're here at Jodrell Bank Observatory.
Yes.
And you're here for BBC Stargazing Live.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering how active of an amateur astronomer you have been, and how much you will be after having done this?
Well, I will be more so. I have been... I have a telescope at home. I have one of those kind of fantastic ones. You press a button and it brings you on a tour. The where we're living at the moment isn't exact. We moved house and it got packed up in a box because it's not ideal. I'm either north or south facing, so I don't get it particularly clear, as in like it, things arrive over the house eventually. And so it's not ideal where I am at the moment. Like, so I got to start packing stuff in the boot of the car, like whatever. But I can seem to be doing a lot more simply from the experience of having this. It has been... it's been fantastically interesting. Yes, I'm quite a go out and have a look at the Perseid meteor shower type thing. I'm very pro that. That's a bit of a personal favourite of mine.
Well, I think you and Brian Cox are doing a great job in that. I think you'll have encouraged people who maybe don't have a telescope that they can go out and do naked eye astronomy.
Well, apparently, naked eye is obviously, if we point out the things that are available in naked eye, that's great. We also found out that telescopes were trending on Amazon after the first show, like immediately after the first show.
Excellent.
People turned to their computers and went, how much is a telescope? So they suddenly became this thing on Amazon. So hopefully, and the viewing figures have been astonishingly good for this. I mean, we would have been happy with about 2 million. It would have been okay in that slot, and it would have been a good solid number, because you'd presume, well, that's a pretty good 3.6 for the first show and 3.2 for the second is phenomenally good. So it's gone great. Yeah,
that is excellent. And now we've heard there's a rumor going around.
Yes,
that you're hosting Stargazing Live as a result of losing a bet.
That was just I'm hosting Stargazing
Live. That was incorrect.
That's incorrect. I am, however, hosting Stargazing Live due to being sold a pup, as we say. I was initially told we want to do a show where we were bringing to Africa. And you sit on top of a mountain at like Cape Town, and you look at the stars. And I went, yeah, I'll do that. It's January. I'd love to have a week in Africa in January. Brilliant. And then I received an email from the BBC going, great news. The shoot is now in Macclesfield. And their chirpy, upbeat tone. And I was on board at that stage. It was too late for me to turn around and go, how dare you know? It was false advertising. Basically, I got lured into do one show, and I got nothing against Macclesfield. My in-laws live in Macclesfield, and my wife rang me and said, "Jesus, every night you say here we are in Macclesfield, like it's the worst place in the world to be." Hey, Macclesfield is fine; it's grand. In fact, I'm technically not even in strictly in Macclesfield, but you know, it's not Africa. I was expecting to finish this tonight, right, and then tomorrow to drive down to the coast. And maybe to go to the Stellenbosch region and have some wine, or maybe go on a safari. That's what I was planning to do. I wasn't planning to go to essentially the Linton Travel Tavern Hotel that we're staying in at the moment, and have a few pints and then get the train back home. So nothing against what we're doing here, and I love what you're doing, and wow, it's great to be in General Bank, but Christ, like every night you should see behind my eyes a small amount of regret that I don't get to hit the beach at any stage during this shoot. Sorry. And you know, it's like they promised me a beach.
So...
pull it together, bad interview technique. Now, pull it together. You're only reading the things off the sheet, for Christ's sake. You know what I mean? Like, yeah.
This is my first interview, Darrell.
I've never interviewed anyone
in my entire life.
Yeah. It is just a form of conversation, so you can't stop. You can't stop in a conversation.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, next thing I was going to ask you is, well, how... You were sold, we'll say, a different vision of this event.
Yes, yes.
But now you're here at the wonderful Jodrell Bank.
At glorious Jodrell
Bank, the home of astronomy in the UK.
I turned to stare at the window, and this is probably the only one that doesn't look at the scope. It's over there. Yeah, it is. It's fantastic. But it's also that proper people do working and people do science here. Just bits of tat lying around and old scientific papers stacked in corners, like, and it's bringing back memories of
this is know. How it's done.
Yes, it is. Yeah, and like of lecturers, things, and you go up to a lecturer's room to ask them questions about something, and they would have piles. There was a guy called Thomas Laffey, who was a lecturer of mathematics, and his room was just this forest, and he looked like one of those hoarding men whose corpses they find when you know nobody's heard from them for 2 weeks and they kick down the door, like whatever, because at some stage proceedings of the Mathematical Society or whatever would have collapsed on him, and he would have been trapped and not be able to, he would have written help in chalk on the blackboard in his room, like whatever, before collapsing. But it is a bit like that. There's like old circuit board and transport. There's also a bell. Why is there a bell?
Ah, the bell here is traditionally to summon people to lectures or colloquia. If there was a guest speaker, everyone would be so engrossed in their research that they'd need some kind of alarming noise to get them to go to.
But that's hilarious, because Cox led on that it was a safety thing, that they're about to move the telescope and here's the bell. Like, yeah, I remember thinking, that can't hold true. Because if the bell is like ding ding, it's like, who would go, oh wow, ding ding? Because it's not even near the telescope.
No.
He's such a bluffer.
There is actually a sound that rings from before the telescope.
Yeah, because I'm sure there's like a horn of some description. Yeah, more than ding ding, like everybody, dinner's ready. Ding ding. Okay, grand. So I want to ring the bell when we finish the last show.
Going to ring it tonight?
Yes, I want to
close
ring it
the show. On live TV?
No, I won't bother ringing live TV. It's not a thing. But I will do it myself. Because I walked past it and I felt I shouldn't ring it because I thought it might signify. But will everyone run out and expect me to deliver a symposium on?
I don't think so. I think it can be used in a celebratory way as well.
Yes.
We hereby confer the power to ring the bell tonight.
Thank you very much. You're very kind.
So, you're here in beautiful Jodrell Bank. Yep. And you're working with some great co-presenters. I was wondering how you were getting on working with them, Professor Brian Cox.
Well, Cox is fantastic. Cox, you just have to occasionally rein him in because he will go proto-nerd on stuff. He will go, I've interviewed conversations with Brian about relativity that involve him talking very fluently and me scratching furiously through 20 years of accumulated dust to find to keep up with them. Like, so with null GD6, and I'm going, Jesus, and null GD6 with GIJ. Always the shape of my null GD6. And so it is, you know, and I'm nodding furiously and then go, to think of a smart person, think of a smart thing to say. So, but there is, you know, I think I fit quite naturally into the, I know a little bit about this, so I can ask questions, but I am on the side of the viewers. Right? Okay. I'm on the side of the 10-year-old boy who reads a bit about this, but needs to know a little bit more. But we're also philosophically, we're in tune in terms of we don't want it to be dumbed down.
Yes.
And I think about a large part of it hasn't been dumbed down.
I think that's correct. And I think you're more than well representing the well-informed, interested amateur.
Yes. Yeah. Which that might be a good way to. Yeah.
So you're also working with Jonathan Ross.
Ross will be in later on today. We are confining him because otherwise he will run rampage through the show because that is his persona. Make a joke about his current appearance. He may not still have the weird cat weasel kind of appearance that he had in the last while. Ross should be in. I haven't seen the pieces. You don't get to see the stuff.
Okay, well,
when it goes up, because when we say, and here is Margaret, we then are running to the next location. So we didn't see, for example, the meteor. We missed the start of all these things. We go over to you, Mark, and then we're off. Okay. And so we missed it.
Well, if you're the well-informed amateur, perhaps Jonathan is the less informed amateur.
Well, listen, if you imagine one of those evolutionary diagrams where it becomes, ape, then hominid, then Australopithecus, then whatever, then basically Cox is evolved man. I am just slightly beyond evolved man, and Jonathan is just crawling out of the ocean.
Okay, well, I can't think of any more questions right now.
That's okay, because often the key to a good interview is brevity, and you get all you can. I feel drained. I feel there's nothing more I can give, and that means it's been a successful interview, because I couldn't say another word at this stage.
Okay,
I'm likely to perform badly in the show tonight. I am so spent by this process.
Okay, well, thank you for sacrificing your time, Dara.
Quite all right.
It's been great having you.
Pleasure, lad. Let's go.
Thanks for that, Evan. And Evan, it was actually mostly down to you that we got to do these interviews, wasn't it?
Yes, myself and Dara are good friends.
Since?
We go way back. In fact, I have many celebrity friends.
Really? Or you just asked him on Twitter?
I may have asked him on Twitter. Dara, as you know, is an avid tweeter. And he seems to be more likely to respond if you tweet at him in his native language, which is also my native language.
So next up, we have an interview with Mark Thompson, and I really don't know how to describe him. He's an amateur astronomer who gets paid to do it, so I guess he's a professional amateur astronomer, but that just sounds stupid.
Professional stargazer, I would have said. He gets paid to stare at the sky and tell people about it.
TV astronomer.
Multimedia astronomer.
Anyway, he was the guy in the field for any of you who watched Stargazing Live, and Mark went to talk to Mark.
I'm here with Mark Thompson, the resident astronomer for BBC's The One Show and the Night Sky Guide on Stargazing Live. Thank you very much for being on the Jodcast.
No problem at all. It's good to be involved in this. The first thing I thought I might ask you is, I know that you're a qualified pilot.
Yes.
How on earth did you end up becoming a TV astronomer?
Well, I've been an amateur astronomer for 25 years or more, so I've had a passion for the night sky for many, many years. I took up flying as a hobby probably around 10 years ago, and so I've qualified as a pilot since I've become an astronomer, but astronomy has always been the passion, and the role as the TV astronomer has just morphed over the years. The pilot thing has just been secondary to all of that.
Have you ever been able to do astronomy from a plane?
Funnily, yes, I was once, this is, if the CIA are listening, I don't want them to know about this, but I was once on an instrument flying lesson, so I had an instructor on board as well, so that, you know, they had another pilot who knew what they were doing, which is good, and I should have been at the time paying attention to all the instruments in the aircraft, which, you know, instrument flying is chiefly about looking at instruments, and I happened to catch out of the corner of my eye Venus. We were above the clouds, and this was just at twilight, just above the clouds were looking sort of lovely velvety kind of purpley colour. It looked stunning. And then Venus was just hovering in the sky, just with a crescent moon nearby as well. And I have to say, my attention was just grasped for a few moments while I was looking at that, instead of paying attention to the instrument. So yes, I have. Legally, no, never. Of course not. Focus on the job. But yes, I have had my attention grabbed on a few occasions, but not in a dangerous way, of course.
You're kind of a compulsive stargazer,
yes.
Then.
Can't let it go.
What is it about actually looking up at the stars whatever's out there in space that really appeals to you?
I think the thing that appeals to me is the enormity of it all, and to a degree, the fact that the more we learn, the more we realise we know nothing. We don't know nothing, we do know an awful lot about stuff, but you know, the more we actually pick up about the universe, we find actually there's still shed loads more we still need to learn. So it's a bit about the unknown, and it's also about the physics behind the stuff that we're looking at. I mean, we can look at the Andromeda Galaxy, which you can see in the sky at this time of year, and it's faint, it's fuzzy, it doesn't look all that impressive, but it's a galaxy with about a trillion stars in it, and the light's taken about 2.5 million years to get here, so you're looking back in time. It's all that kind of stuff, so it's knowing actually what you're looking at rather than just purely looking at the object itself.
Yeah, so when you can look at something from your back garden that's just completely mind-boggling.
Absolutely. I mean, there are objects you can see through an amateur telescope where the light left before the Earth was even here. So, you know, light has taken over 5 billion years to get here. So, you know, anyone can go outside in the garden tonight with a basic telescope, look at certain galaxies, and the light left that galaxy before the Earth had even formed. And that is just wacky. So you're looking back in time when you're doing astronomy, even amateur astronomy. The sun is, you know, the sun's about 8.5 minutes away. Mm. So if the sun were to just disappear, we wouldn't know about it visually for about 8.5 minutes. And so, you know, kind of stuff is just really bizarre. Because we're so used to, you know, distance you to from me, you know, it takes nanoseconds, probably less than that, for light to get to me. But in the universe, it takes time for light to get places.
Yeah.
Weird.
You get the idea of how space and time are bound up together.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you do. Totally.
So coming back to popular astronomy.
Yes.
Do you think, in terms of popularizing astronomy now, that new user-driven services, kind of blogging and podcasting and social networking sites, that are more important in spreading popular astronomy than the traditional media like TV?
I would say as important, certainly. I mean, I think, when you know, you've got, I don't know if I can advertise on it, but you know, you've got Twitter, you know, that's a fantastic system. There's projects out there. There's a project called Meteor Watch. I don't know if you've seen it, where people can tweet when they see a meteor, and that and then gets pumped through to a map and get alerts for space station flypasts. There's all sorts of stuff that you can get. So I think TV is good for sort of general information and for getting people out there, perhaps really, you know, wowing them with the graphics and the multimedia side of it. But, you know, I think the whole sort of technology stuff, I mean, you can get apps on iPhones and on HTC phones, all that kind of stuff, and they show you what you can see in the sky. I mean, I was using it last night because it was cloudy. I just wanted to kind of get my head around where Jupiter would be broadly, so I couldn't see a damn thing out there.
Yeah.
And I fired up an application on the phone and just said, you know, it's actually going to be right over there. So I knew exactly where it would be, so I didn't have to waste time, you know, tarting around trying to think, oh, no, is it over there? Is it over there? So all those applications and the technology is brilliant, and I think that's where it's good to help people learn the sky.
Yeah. And did you come into your role that you've got now through those kind of new services?
Not really. I mean, it's kind of come about since then. I did a lot of work with local media. That's back in Norfolk where I live. So I did a lot of work with the local newspaper, local TV. I've only been involved in probably more national astronomy stuff for probably about 2.5 years now. So I'm quite new into it. But even in that time, that technology has changed dramatically, and it is now so much easier for people to get involved in doing astronomy, and that's the beautiful thing about it all now.
When you're not doing TV sort of work, what kind of astronomical things do you like to do?
Oh, crikey, all sorts of things. I've kind of got a passion for imaging, so taking photographs of the sky. So one of the things I do when I'm not doing astronomy, if you like, is probably tampering around with pictures, making them look pretty.
Yeah.
And I use the word tampering a bit reservedly because, you know, some people think, well, you know, if you're enhancing pictures, then you're changing them from what they really are. But you're not. You're actually just enhancing them. And a good analogy, I think, is the old red eye reduction.
Mm.
You've all seen photographs of people that have been taken. Flash has gone off and you've got the little red pupils in people. And people have no problem with just, you know, getting that airbrushed out or using the flash reduction on or whatever. So there's no difference. What you're doing is you're just making the picture look appealing and look more, you know, more scientifically accurate.
It's just like having better eyes, isn't it?
Yeah, sometimes. It is. And, you know, in a sense, a telescope is doing that for you as well, because a telescope is acting like a funnel for your eyes. So if people are going to be so precious about it, you shouldn't even use a telescope. You know, put them all away, forget about them. You're tampering with what you can see. So, you know, a telescope is affecting and changing what you can see in the eye, and it makes your eye as big as the telescope. I mean, the pupil is about, I don't know, 2.5-3 millimeters across, whatever it is when it's dilated. And if you use a telescope that's maybe 4, 5, 10, 12 inches across, you've got an eye that big. So, you know, all of a sudden you're going to see so much more information.
It was amazing on Stargazing Live, actually, to see the guide to how you could easily take astrophotographs.
Yes.
Some of those methods were so non-specialist.
Yeah,
but they produced such good results.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people know that, certainly in the astronomy world, know you can DSLR camera, plug onto the back of the telescope or stick it on a tripod, get constellation shots. But the bit that, for me, some of the images I saw, you know, the guys who just got a bog-standard compact camera, stuck it to the eyepiece of a telescope and pushed the button, you know, how much more basic can you get?
Mm.
And there was a stunning image of Saturn near the limb of the moon. And that was an incredible picture.
I saw that one.
Now when you think, I don't know, a couple hundred years ago, nobody could have done that. And for someone to just got probably a 20 quid camera out of the chemist down the road and just got that snap just as simply as that, it was incredible. So yeah, I mean, there are some really easy techniques people can use. You can go to the more complex methods, you know, webcam imaging.
That's not that complex.
It's not
webcams are quite.
Yeah, webcams are easy enough to use. And, you know, as a clip showed, there's really simple software out there that will help you do it. So as long as you've got a webcam and a telescope, you can get pictures. Probably the hardest thing to do is to get the object in the centre of the telescope. So you've got it in the middle of the webcam field, because chips in the webcam, I've never seen them. They're about, I don't know, a centimetre square.
Mm.
So trying to get the image right in the middle so that when you stick the webcam in, you've got it. Because believe you or me, when you're trying, if you're looking at a webcam image or live feed from a webcam, and all you can see is black sky and no guide as to know whether you're just above it or just below it, you can waste hours trying to get the thing in the centre of the field of view.
But persistence pays off.
And, you know, my eyepieces have got crosshairs on them, so you know you've got things right in the middle. But, yeah, absolutely, persistence does pay off. And just with webcams, I mean, I've seen some stunning images of Jupiter and Saturn almost competing with spacecraft images. Well, you know, there's some amazing images out there. And it's all done with amateur equipment, and that's just incredible.
So as the real stargazer among the presenting team on
the
Stargazing
only
Live,
stargazer.
Should we say the real astronomer?
Yeah, say that. The others are just theoretical physicists, aren't they? They don't count, they're not real.
I was going to ask you if you taught them a thing or two
about
how to look at
the sky. They only ever came outside for about 5 minutes on both shows so far. That's shocking.
It was cold on the first day.
Yeah, tell me it's cold. I've been out there for hours. I've even got down there, I'm going on a rant, I apologise. Even got down there heated boots. Oh. They're a thing of the future. They have three heat settings, low, medium and high, and they will keep my feet toasty warm for 8 hours.
How do you keep your fingers warm when you're playing with a telescope?
Yeah, they get cold. It's called gloves. It's quite a new thing. You can get heated gloves. You can get heated, but I haven't gone to that extent. I'm hard. Yeah, I can take the cold. It doesn't affect me.
Would you say Dara O'Brien and Brian Cox are not very hard and not tough?
No, they're softies, both of them. And I hope you listen to it, both of you. It's quite funny because on the show a number of times they've been speaking to Liz over in Hawaii and saying how cold it is over here in Macclesfield. They think it's cold sitting in a nice warm studio, do they? Yeah, get them outside, then we'll see. But it's good fun. It's good fun.
It is. Well, I think sometimes when it's cold, you get really good seeing, don't you?
You do.
You really see the sky.
The best. Unfortunately, last night was colder than Monday night because there was a bit of wind, and of course you get the good old wind chill factor was affecting it. So last night it was cold and it was cloudy, and with the exception of the meteor, which disappeared behind my head, which I never saw.
That was a brilliant moment.
I must have been the only person in the entire country who didn't see that meteor. And I was gutted. But it was superb for the show, you know. If you're going to have a cloudy night, then you want something just to spice it up a little bit, then, yeah, put a meteor behind the guy's head who just said it's cloudy and you can't see anything. That'll work all right. But Twitter went mad after that as well. We had loads of them coming through, which is great. And again, you know, it just shows how the interaction between TV and all these new media is fantastic. I mean, the Twitter hashtag that we've got has been going mental. It trended worldwide on the first night and was fourth in the world. And, you know, wow. that is incredible for a UK-based show as well.
So you can really see what people are saying to you as well about
yeah,
what
Yeah, no, absolutely you can. Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I've not gone through the entire list. We had email questions have come in. We had about, I think, 7,000 questions came in via email on the first night.
Wow.
And so, you know, trying to fit, you know, just to get a sample of those, you know, it's been a fantastic response. It's just great how the people who are watching the show can interact with the show. And, you know, that is fantastic.
Yeah. What I was going to ask you perhaps the last thing is sometimes people refer to astronomers as astrologers.
Yes, they do.
I was wondering if anyone's ever asked you to tell their fortune.
Yes. Yeah. Well, not that in so many words, but people will quite often say, oh, you're an astrologer, are you? And they'll even say, oh, you're an astronomer, are you? I'm a Leo. No, astrologer. So, yes, I get loads of people will say, oh, you do? Oh, yeah, I'm into that. Yeah, I'm a Leo. Yeah, what are you? No. So, yes, I get loads of that. Loads and loads and loads of that.
Okay.
But they only do it once.
Right.
They only do it once.
You only get one chance.
Then they learn. Then they learn never to do it again.
You teach them of all the constellations.
I just beat them up and then they're fine about it after that.
Well, I suppose going back into sort of ancient times, some of the first observers were astrologers.
Mm. Absolutely.
I don't know exactly what it was that motivated people to try and start making those kind of predictions. Is it just that you see something that's so amazing you think this must have mean something?
I think if you sort of go back to, I don't know, 5, 6, 7,000 years when they had no concept of anything going on. If we had a partial eclipse of the sun the other morning, although we really just caught the thing here, we were up at 6 o'clock filming for it, and it was cloudy and wet and horrible. But if you imagine the sun's up there, total solar eclipse, all of a sudden the sun disappears.
Terrifying.
I mean, it's going to scare the living daylights out of you. So immediately you're going to try and put some kind of context around it. Of course, back then they believed in gods and all that sort of thing. So you can understand absolutely why people would have attributed that to, you know, some kind of higher being trying to communicate or whatever. And of course they'd sacrifice people to the sun that's disappeared and then the sun comes back again.
Mm.
So it works. We must be right. We'll do it again next time. So you can see how all that kind of builds up. And you're right. I mean, astrology was the first subject that was around. Astronomy didn't come for a lot of years. And it was only until we started to understand and ask the questions around what was really going on in the universe that astronomy evolved as a science and the two finally sort of diverged. It's just a shame that a lot of people still follow astrology.
Yeah, well, it must say something to people's psyche that they want to believe.
People like to have something to believe on. If someone says to you, hey, you're going to have a cracking day today, you'll believe them. If someone says, yeah, actually, you're going to have a rubbish day, just stay at home. You think, yeah, what do you know? Just shut up. So people will like to hear good things. And you never read, not they do read horoscopes for the record, but you never read a horoscope that says your day is going to go from bad to worst. You know, you're going to lose your job. You're going to do this. You're going to do that. Just give up now. You know, do you know what? You never see bad stuff in them. So you kind of have to question, is it? That's rubbish. I'm going on now.
But what you can see up there is interesting enough in itself.
It is. Isn't it really? Yeah. Absolutely. And interestingly, there's more people now that believe in astrology in some way than have ever done before. And that worries me because we're more scientifically aware than we've ever been.
Mm.
And yet there's more people that kind of have a belief in astrology. And that's shocking. But you're right. In the sky, there's so much really interesting stuff that we can prove. So you'd kind of hope people would start to think about that rather than whether it's going to, you know, win the pools or the lottery next week.
Right, well, maybe it's the very last question I should ask you. What's your most favourite thing to look at in the night sky?
Except meteors that are behind me.
Meteors that are in front of you.
Probably Saturn. Now, I mean, I'm not a planetary person. I've got more of a passion for the stuff in the outer edges of the universe, the fainter stuff. It's not, mm-hmm. not as immediately impacting visually. But it is Saturn. You know, Saturn is the first thing I ever saw through a telescope, and it stuck with me ever since, and that's 20-odd years ago now. And so I think you can never fail, never tire to look at planets because they're big, they're bright, they're easy to find, and they just look incredible. They look like they should look. But, you know, all the other stuff like the galaxies and the star clusters, you kind of have to rely on imaging techniques to be able to show them for what they are. Visually, they don't look like an awful lot. So there's a lot of messing around. But a planet, you point a telescope at it, boom, there it is.
Seeing it for yourself is something else.
It is. You know, you can see images from spacecraft and from Hubble Space Telescope, all that kind of stuff. But to see it yourself live, you know, to a quote, stargazing live, to see it for real is the most incredible thing you'll ever have.
Brilliant. Well, cool. Perhaps we can wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks for that, Mark. And if you want to know what you can see in the night sky each month, don't forget to check out our monthly night sky section in the main show in February. Now, for our final interview, Jen had the pleasure to interview Professor Brian Cox from the University of Manchester.
It's a great pleasure to be joined today by Professor Brian Cox from the University of Manchester. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us today.
What, to turn up at my university? Taking busy time out of schedule to turn up at my home institute. Yeah.
So a lot of our listeners will know you as the rock star physicist, the presenter of Wonders of the Solar System, the keyboard player from D-Ream. But we also have listeners in other countries who might not know who you are. So let's wipe the slate clean. How would you describe yourself to our listeners?
Well, my proper job is a professor at the University of Manchester, a particle physicist. So I work at, when I'm not messing around doing television shows, at CERN in Geneva on the Large Hadron Collider. And actually other bits of particle physics started actually designing supernova neutrino observatories. We can talk about that later.
Most of our listeners might not know much about particle physics. Could you give us a 2-minute summary of particle physics? Is that possible?
Yeah, I mean, particle physics at the most basic level is the study of the building blocks of nature, so that the smallest building blocks of nature that we can find. But I think more importantly, the study of three of the four forces of nature. So there are four forces. There's gravity, which is perhaps the most familiar, but by far the weakest. And it's so weak that only astronomers care about it, so particle physicists dismiss it out of hand, which is not exactly true, actually. Maybe we'll get to that later, because there's a possibility we could have something to say about gravity at the Large Hadron Collider, but it's a real outside chance. But the other three forces, forces that operate in the subatomic world, electromagnetism is probably, again, a very familiar force. And then there are two forces that operate in the nucleus, the strong and weak nuclear forces. So particle physics is really more than the search for other particles. I think really the study of three of the four forces of nature.
And we always have, in astronomy, we always have acronyms. So you work at the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider. So large and collider are pretty obvious. What are hadrons?
Well, hadrons, so you could say just protons, right? So a proton is a hadron. But so the LHC in its normal running mode collides protons together. And actually, it can collide up to 600 million together every second at 99.99999% the speed of light. So it's an impressive machine. But it can also collide other things together that are made of protons and neutrons. So at the moment, actually, it's just been colliding lead nuclei together, so the nuclei of lead. So that's why hadron is kind of a generic name for those particles, and it's not called the Large Proton Collider because we can actually put pretty much anything in it that's got an electric charge. It wouldn't do very well with neutrons because they'd go in a straight line. And it's circular, so it wouldn't last long because there'd be no way of steering them around corners.
I've just got this image now.
Oh, don't! Yeah, yeah. You put the neutrons in, they've just gone on. Yeah. You can't accelerate them anyway. Neutrons are difficult things because they've got no charge, so you can't really do much with them.
You mentioned neutrinos from supernovae as well, and they're very difficult particles to detect. Could you tell us what a neutrino is and how that links into supernovae?
Yeah, so there are 12 fundamental building blocks of matter that we know of. And you only need three of them, actually, to make up you and me and the Earth and stars and galaxies. We can get to that later as well. But at the stuff you can see in the universe, you only need three particles. You need up and down quarks, which make up the protons and neutrons, which make up the nuclei of atoms. And you need electrons to go around the atoms. And then in that family, the family of things you need to build a universe, there's one more thing called the neutrino. And it's very kind of esoteric in a way because they interact very weakly with normal matter. But they're absolutely key to understanding how stars work. I mean, what the sun does is it makes hydrogen out of helium out of hydrogen. So it sticks protons together to make helium, which are two protons and two neutrons. In that process, you've got to convert protons into neutrons. So that the force that does that is the weak force. And every time you do that, you produce a neutrino. So the kind of takeaway figure, and you know, there's slightly different numbers for this, but the general takeaway figure is that the sun, it burns 600 million tons of hydrogen every second into helium. It's a huge amount. That's a lot of neutrinos. And at the Earth, there are something like 50 or 60 billion per centimetre squared per second passing through the Earth as a result of the nuclear reactions in the sun.
That's a really large number to get your head around.
Yeah, but they don't... they virtually bump into nothing. They go straight through the Earth and impede most of them. And that's because the weak nuclear force is very short range. Especially weak's kind of the wrong word to use, really. It's quite strong if you're very close to something.
But how close are we talking?
Well, no, subatomic dimensions. So, basically, a neutrino has to go very close to a nucleus or an electron to have any chance of interacting with it. And the reason for that is that the particles that carry the weak force, so this might be a strange concept, but the way that a particle physicist would say that electromagnetism works, so two charged particles, if you bring them together, they repel if they've got the same charge. A particle physicist would say that a photon, which is the carrier of the electromagnetic force, jumps between them. So particles called photons, which are also particles of light, carry the electromagnetic force. In the same way, there's particles called W and Z bosons, which are very similar to photons, actually, which carry the weak force. And they're very heavy. They're very massive. They're as massive as nuclei of gold, right, which is strange. And that makes the weak force very weak. And actually, one of the main things we're doing at the LHC is looking for the reason for that mass. So you might have heard of this thing called the Higgs particle, which everybody calls various names and everybody's been searching for years. But the reason that we really need to understand that is to understand why, how these things that carry the weak force got heavy, got massive. So that's one of the big things we're doing at the LHC. That's a big answer, isn't it?
That was a big answer.
That's particle physics.
Yeah.
Right.
I've got like so many questions to break off on that. First of all, if neutrinos don't interact with things, how do you detect them?
Well, they do. They interact via the weak force.
Right.
So they have a very low probability of interacting with matter. I suppose you could say because matter's not very dense. So if you fired neutrinos into something like a neutron star, they'd have a very high probability of bumping into something because it's really dense. But so it's really because of the diffuse nature of matter, I suppose, and the short range nature of the weak force that they just pass through. So another way of saying it is that they don't have any electric charge. If things that have electric charge, like electrons and quarks and protons, they just bump into things very easily. And things that have the strong charge, actually, so interact by the strong nuclear force, again, so that's neutrons, they'll bump into things very easily. But neutrinos are unique in the particle zoo, if you want to call it that, because they only interact by the weak force. So it's not very probable they'll bump into anything.
So we need very large detectors to get them.
So there's a low probability. So one way of doing it is to have a big tank of water under a mountain in Japan, which is what we do. It's called Kamiokande. It doesn't have to be Japan, but they just had the right mountain and the will to build the thing. And that's just a huge tank of water, essentially. So you get, 10 or 20, I'm not sure what the exact number is, but maybe 10 or 20 neutrinos from the sun, from these billions and billions per centimeter squared per second. You get 10 or 20 every day, maybe a few more, bumping into something in the water, and you can detect that. So that's how we know. So we know that they're there. We can detect them, but it's just difficult.
I've seen a really cool picture from that detector, I think. It's of the sun, but taken through the Earth in neutrinos. And yeah. That's just crazy to think about. You can take a photo of the sun through the Earth.
Yeah.
Can we talk a bit more about what you actually work on? I know there's four experiments at CERN. So which one do you work on?
Yeah, I work on ATLAS. But actually, I also worked on a joint project. This is the thing that I did for many years, actually, with ATLAS and CMS, which is the other big detector at CERN, to put little detectors very close to the beams. So just to picture this experiment, the LHC is 27 kilometres in circumference, and it has two beams of protons going around it, one in each direction. And the beams, when they cross, are about the diameter of a human hair, but they carry the energy of an aircraft carrier travelling at 30 miles an hour. Right?
Whoa. So
and what I decided to do with a few friends of mine was put detectors 3 millimetres away from them. Right.
Right.
it's actually to detect collisions where the protons, they collide but just glance off each other. And then they go all the way. So they almost don't come out of the beam, really. They almost don't collide. But they exchange a tiny bit of energy, but they stay intact. And that those protons actually come out of the beams 420 metres away from the point at which they crossed. Wow. So it's almost half a kilometre away. And at that point, you can grab them between about 3 and 7 millimetres away from the beams. And it's quite nice because one way of producing particles like Higgs particles, which is one of the things we want to search for, is to have these protons just lose a bit of energy, glance off each other, stay intact. You produce a Higgs in the central detector, so an ATLAS or CMS that you see decay. but you measure its mass from detecting how much energy the protons lost, because they just lose all the energy they lose in their little glancing collision goes into making the Higgs. So it's called central exclusive production. And so I worked on that for many years, which is a joint project. I ran that project for a long time. And actually CMS are going ahead with it probably more forcefully than Atlas now. So actually my experiment, the project I ran is going to be realised on a different experiment to the one that I'm on probably.
You mentioned earlier about gravity being a force that particle physicists don't care about, but then you alluded that maybe it is more important to particle physicists than originally thought. So could you expand on that a bit?
Yeah, I mean, so gravity is sort of a million, a bit more than that actually, times weaker than the other three forces. So that's one of the big questions in physics, actually. Why? Yeah, because on that scale, the other three forces are about as strong as each other. And just gravity is radically different. So, I mean, the standard textbook view would be that gravity is in some sense not really a force. It's there because space and time are curved by massive objects. So it's in a way it's a fictitious force. It's a good analogy is that the Earth's surface is curved. So if you set off with your friend and stand at the equator and start walking parallel to each other, then you'll bump into each other at the North Pole. So because parallel means going up a line of longitude. Yeah. So you'll walk up there and you'll bump into them. So if you didn't know that the Earth's surface was curved, then you would say there was a force acting between you that was pulling you together, obviously, because you were walking parallel and you bumped into each other. So you got closer together. So you would assume there's a force. Now, there isn't. It's because the surface of the Earth is curved. So that's Einstein's explanation for gravity, because space-time is curved by things like, curved by everything that has mass, actually, or energy, but you don't see it very much unless you've got a sun or a planet there, and then you feel that force. So but that's not satisfactory for many reasons. That sets it aside from the other three forces. But there are good reasons to think that that shouldn't be the final description of it. I mean, one of the best ones, a friend of mine said, actually, an astrophysicist said, well, look, if you think of a star that collapses, right, why would you want this theory of gravity? Well, massive stars, they supernova happens and they explode, and then you get left with a black hole. So a star can collapse to something that's essentially a point-like thing, right, a singularity, a black hole. So there's a transition between a big thing and something which is quantum-sized, but is obviously something to do with gravity because it's a black hole, right? So why do you want a quantum theory of gravity? Because you would want some continuous description of the collapse of a star. And that's kind of a good thing, because Einstein's theory breaks down in a black hole. I mean, literally, that word singularity is a mathematical term, really. It means that all your theory just predicts complete nonsense. It's unable to predict anything when you've got something that's so small and so dense that it's atomic size but the mass of a sun. Einstein's theory does not work, but some theory should, and it should be something that's able to deal with particles and things like that. So you might think that there should be a quantum theory of gravity, right? So having said that preamble, speculative idea for why gravity is so weak is that there are extra dimensions in the universe. So literally there's four dimensions in our universe at the moment, three space and one of time. Well, you can have more. And you can have them, we could either be on a little sheet, a four-dimensional sheet floating around in a bigger multi-dimensional universe, or there could be dimensions that are curled up. And actually the radius, so the analogy here is that if you look at a hose pipe a long way away at the bottom of your garden, then from way up the garden in your house, it looks like a line. So it looks like a two-dimensional thing. But if you get close to it, you see that it's not. It's curved into another dimension. It's a three-dimensional thing. It's a pipe. Mm. So you can build theories like that, where there are curled up extra dimensions. And one of the ideas is that the reason gravity looks weak to us is because it has to bother with all the extra dimensions. So uniquely amongst the forces, it's the one that has to travel through 10 dimensions rather than four. And so it just gets diluted, basically. So that all sounds like science fiction, but if it's true, we can detect the signatures of extra dimensions if they're big enough and set up right at LHC. It's one of the things people look for at LHC, is extra dimensions in the universe.
Wow. My head's just blown right now.
I should hurry up, actually, because I've got to go on this stuff now.
Well, I mean, I was going to ask you all about the connections between astrophysics and particle physics, but I guess we've kind of covered that.
There's some there. I mean, my connection, personally, is that I started doing an astrophysics degree at Manchester, and then went into theoretical physics. But then my first year of my PhD was designing detectors to detect neutrinos from supernova. So I kind of have always flitted between the two, actually. They're very similar. So astroparticle physics, I suppose, is a field that I've always wandered in and out of.
Yeah. And just before we finish, can I just ask you about your interest in astronomy and looking at the stars, moving away a little bit from astrophysics, because astronomy and astrophysics are kind of almost two separate things. You've got, you know, astronomy where you look at the stars and then astrophysics where you explain them. So were you always interested in amateur astronomy, or was that something that came later in life when you started studying physics?
No, always interested. From as far back as I can remember, I was interested in both space flight, actually, space exploration, planetary science and astronomy. That was when I was four, that's what I was into. So that's why I did astrophysics at university to start with. So it's always, just for some reason, it's always been an interest.
Well, thank you very much. I think we're out of time. Would love for you to come and talk to us for longer in Manchester if you ever have the time.
Yeah, well, I'd love to. I mean, when I finally get back to Manchester and actually do some lectures or something. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Thanks for that, Jen. And if you enjoyed that and want to see photos of Jen swooning over Professor
Brian
Cox...
I was not swooning.
You were very keen to do that interview, though.
Well, there's plenty of photos the listeners can judge for themselves. We'll link to them in the show notes.
So now we get onto the part of the show where we talk about all the little bits that we couldn't fit in anywhere else. And one of the reasons for Stargazing Live to be at the beginning of January was that there was a partial solar eclipse on the 4th of January, which was visible from much of Europe and I think parts of Africa and Asia as well. So there's a lot of good photos from that. Evan, do you want to talk about some first?
Yes, there's a lot of good photos, a lot of good optical photos. But one thing that you don't usually see, which I've managed to come across, are radio images of the eclipse. An astronomer by the name of Niko Lavinen, who I had the pleasure of meeting last year, he works at the Metsähovi telescope in Finland, and he's constructed a series of images of the eclipse, but radio images, and he's made a nice animation of that.
Radio images? I never really think of the sun as a radio emitter.
Yes, the sun emits at all wavelengths, most prominently in the optical. That's why we can see in the optical. But at radio wavelengths, simply because it's so close, it's also extremely bright in the radio.
So there's also been a lot of good optical photos of the solar eclipse. One amazing one, which I hope everyone has seen already, but if you haven't, you have to go and check this one out. This is a picture of the sun being eclipsed while the ISS, the International Space Station, is passing over it. And it was taken by a guy called Thierry Legault. I'm not quite sure how you pronounce his
name.
Legault. It was astronomy picture of the day on 5th of January, and it's just incredible. I can't believe...
I mean, I think this guy is an accomplished astrophotographer, so he's had to work out where he needs to be to take this photo. And, in fact, he had 1 second in which to take it when the ISS passed the face of the sun.
The NASA Goddard Space Flight Center Flickr group has also conveniently collected together some good eclipse photos so we don't have to. So we'll link to that as well. And also, something that you don't see very often is that they've got a movie of the eclipse from space. So this is the view from the Hinode satellite, which is out there observing the sun, but has taken photos of the eclipse as the eclipse happened as well, and they've put together a little movie of that, and that's really cool. You never really think of eclipses from space. Something that's going on at the moment as we record is the 217th meeting of the American Astronomical Society. And these are meetings that happen, I think, twice a year. And you always get loads of press releases, lots of exciting results being presented at these meetings. And we're going to have a full roundup in the next show, but we thought we'd give you some tidbits to start off with.
Firstly, there's a new image of Hennie's Voorwerp. And I'd like to apologise to all my Dutch friends for probably mispronouncing that. I believe it means object or thingy, which we discussed previously in May 2008 with Chris Lintott. Hennie's Voorwerp was found by somebody called Hennie, and it's a strange-looking green object found in Galaxy Zoo.
Another exciting discovery come out of the AAS meeting in Seattle was the detection of the first rocky exoplanet. This was discovered by NASA's Kepler satellite. So this is the smallest planet to date that has been found outside our solar system. It's about 1.4 times the mass of the Earth, but it's very close to its host star. In fact, it's too close to be able to support life.
The last bit of breaking news we had from the meeting was that a gamma ray detector in space called Fermi has actually managed to detect antimatter coming out of lightning storms on the Earth. So it was a direct detection of antimatter naturally produced by Earth's storms.
Another exciting piece of news is the first scientific results from Planck were released at a press briefing in Paris on January the 11th. These results are really interesting, although they don't focus on the cosmological side of Planck, i.e. looking at the afterglow of the Big Bang, the cosmic microwave background. They actually discuss all the other light that we can see, all the light from our own galaxy, all them external galaxies that are actually causing us to not be able to see the cosmic microwave background.
So this is basically the cosmologists' rubbish.
Yes.
And they're turning it into science.
Yes, this is all the stuff that the cosmologists just don't care about. They just want it removed. But to actually remove it, you need to understand it. One of the things that was released, one of the results that was released, was the early release compact source catalogue. And this is a list of approximately 15,000 sources, ranging from cool, dense sites of star formation within our own galaxy to clusters of galaxies, which are among the largest structures that we can see in the universe. Also, something more close to my heart, Planck data has been used to try and enable us to understand the anomalous microwave emission, which is just another foreground component of our galaxy, but it's something that's not completely understood.
Okay, and if you're interested in Planck, we've covered it quite a bit on the show. The launch, which was on the 14th of May 2009, is in the May Extra 2009. And Mark also interviewed the Planck project scientist, Dr. Jan Tauber, in the July 2010 Extra edition.
Also, if you want to know more about anomalous microwave emission, the Jodcast interviewed Professor Rod Davies in September 2009.
And now, answering your astronomical questions, a man who is no Planck, a very clever guy, Dr. Tim O'Brien.
So we had a number of questions this month that arose out of the Stargazing Live programme that came through on from various sources like Twitter and so on. We had a number of questions about planets, I think based on the first programme in Stargazing Live, which concentrated on planets. And in particular, one of the popular questions was relating to gas giant planets like Jupiter and asking, you know, where's the surface? How do we define the edge of Jupiter if it's made of gas? Now, of course, you know, it's a good question because the atmosphere is basically gas. It's quite extended. And in fact, when you look up what the size of Jupiter is, for example, the sort of diameter of Jupiter, the published values actually define the edge of the planet as when the pressure in the atmosphere of Jupiter or one of the other giant planets is 1 bar, which is approximately equal to sort of the atmospheric pressure of the Earth on the Earth at sea level. So obviously the higher up you go in the atmosphere, the lower the atmospheric pressure. You've got less weight of atmosphere pressing down on you. And the same would be true in a planet like Jupiter. Now it turns out it doesn't actually make a huge amount of difference exactly what you use there, in the sense that the change between, say, defining the edge of Jupiter as being 1 bar to maybe 1,000 times less, in other words, higher up in the atmosphere, only changes the size by about 100 kilometers compared to the sort of diameter of Jupiter of, you know, getting on for 150,000 kilometers or so. So that's basically the answer, is it? You do have to make a call on what you call the edge of a gas planet, and that's how it's defined in terms of the atmospheric pressure at that point. There were also quite a few questions relating to Pluto, and people were getting obviously some people still out there are a little bit upset about the fact that Pluto is not defined as a planet anymore, and we've redefined it as a dwarf planet. You should listen back to one of the Jodcasts back from 2006 when that decision was made. We've actually got a good episode there on that whole story of the decision to reclassify Pluto. And I think the only thing I would say about it at this stage is that it always used to... It made me think that actually it was unfortunate for our moon, in the sense that our moon is actually bigger than Pluto. It's actually weighs five times more than Pluto, and our moon doesn't get to be called a planet. So how come Pluto gets to be called one? And really, that's just to do with chance, in the sense that the moon is actually a satellite of the Earth. So basically, Pluto is very small, much less massive, very different from the eight classic planets that we know. That we now use. Hazza McCoy on Twitter asked a question about gas giants again. Why are gas giants bigger with stronger gravity yet have no density when the smaller planets are much, much smaller? Well, it's true that the gas giants are bigger and they're more massive, and therefore the gravity's are going to be stronger. They don't have no density, though, and the small planets like the Earth are not much, much denser. In fact, the average density of the Earth, for example, is about 5.5 grams per cubic centimeter. So if you just took a little volume of space that was 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter of a typical material from the Earth, that would weigh 5.5 grams. For Jupiter, it would weigh 1.3 grams. So it's only 4 times less dense than the Earth. And actually, that's about the same as what it is for the Sun. And the reason that the average density of the Sun and Jupiter, for example, is less than that of the Earth is because they're made of different stuff. So basically, Jupiter and the Sun are mostly hydrogen and helium. So in terms of by the weight of material, the Sun and the gas giant planets are basically, they're about 74% hydrogen and about 24% helium. And the remaining 2% is all the other elements. So all the elements like iron and carbon and oxygen and so on. So completely dominated by hydrogen and helium, the Sun and the gas giants. Whereas if you look at Earth, it's actually almost half of the Earth's mass is made up of oxygen, a quarter or so of it is made up of silicon. And then you start to get, 8% aluminium, 5% iron and so on. And hydrogen is only 0.14% of the mass of the Earth. And basically that's just to do with how these planets formed and were they formed in the solar system in terms of the distance from the Sun and what materials were available in a solid form and which could condense to make the planets. So a lot of people were asking why the gas giants formed further away than the rocky planets and how can you have gas giants when it's so far away from the Sun so it's too cold for gas and so on. Well, The usual assumption about how planets form is they form by bits of stuff basically sticking together within a disk at the center of which the Sun forms. So you've got basically this cloud of gas and dust that collapses in on itself under its own weight. And in the middle of that cloud, the Sun forms. And out in the disk, the planets form by stuff sticking together initially to make larger and larger lumps of material gradually. And then if those lumps get big enough, the gravity is actually strong enough to attract in more material. And you grow these things called planetismals. So they're sort of like baby planets. Now, it turns out that the material that's available to you is going to depend on what's, for example, condensed into a solid form. And that depends how far away you are from the Sun. And that's why you get different compositions of planets at different distances. So the gas giants are made of different stuff than the sort of rocky planets. We think Jupiter, for example, probably does have a solid core deep inside it, but it's managed to gather, to attract all this huge, extensive, massive gaseous atmosphere around it. So that's basically the story. Of course, we only ever had one example of planetary system to look at, which was the solar system, until somewhat over 10 years ago, 15 years ago or so now, when we started to find lots of other planets around other stars. And then we found actually that gas giant planets around other stars, you could actually find them quite close to the stars, much, much closer than Mercury is to our own Sun. We find these things called hot Jupiters. Now, we think that those planets probably formed at large distances again, but they've migrated inwards. They've basically moved inwards close to the Sun by either interactions with other planets, so that sort of swings them in, if you like, by the gravitational pull, and as they pass close by to other planets in those planetary systems, or maybe by interactions within the sort of forming disk, the disk that all those planets formed out of. So it's a really live topic, is asking the question of how planets formed, and it's been stimulated by finding all these planets around other stars. Okay, we had a question from Mark Cooper, who emailed in to ask how we create images from the signals we receive from a radio telescope. And he'd seen the Stargazing Live program and seen the bit where I was showing Dara how we, talking about how the radio telescope, like the Lovell telescope, works, and then talking about E. Merlin. Now, one thing Mark mentions in his question is he thinks that maybe you could perhaps point your telescope in one direction and gather a signal from that direction, and then move your telescope a little bit and gather the signal from that direction, and perhaps that's how we make an image. Well, you can do that. You know, a big radio telescope like the Lovell telescope We point it in one direction and we measure the strength of the radio signal from that direction in the sky. And you could sort of do a thing like a raster scan, basically, where you sort of move the telescope along a bit, then measure the brightness in that direction, move it along a bit more, measure the brightness again, and perhaps build up row after row after row to build up an image. That's how you might do it with a single radio telescope, basically picks up radio waves coming from one direction. But what we do with something like eMERLIN, when we have arrays of radio telescopes, we have several radio telescopes spread across large distances, is rather different. And the way to think about it, if you think about eMERLIN, it has seven radio telescopes. There's two here at Jodrell, five spread across the country between here and Cambridge, spread across a diameter of about 217 kilometres. Now, they're like, you've got to imagine that that's like a giant telescope, 217 kilometres across, of which we've only got seven bits. So if you can imagine seven points on the surface of this sort of virtual dish that's 217 kilometres across, they would reflect radio waves up to a focus that you'd imagine would be on this giant tower we'd build in Birmingham or something with the focus at the top of it, in the middle of this virtual dish. Now, we don't do that. We actually collect the signals at each point, at each of these telescopes, and then we bring them back to Jodrell Bank where we combine them together. So we use a machine called a correlator. It's basically a supercomputer that combines these signals. Now, what it does is it combines the signals in pairs. So we take the signal as received from each pair of telescopes, and of course there's quite a few different pairs that you can make up from seven individual telescopes, but each of those points are like two points on the surface of this sort of virtual telescope that we'd like to have built, that was this huge 217-kilometre sized one. Each pair of points gives us a particular bit of information about the distribution of light or radio waves on the sky. The farther apart the two points are, so the farther apart the two telescopes are, the finer detail we're able to see. And the angle of those two points, those two telescopes on the ground, if you like, also gives us information about the structure of the image. So by combining all those different pairs of telescopes together, we start to build up an image. We're very limited in the quality of that image by the fact that we've only got seven telescopes. We'd love to have many more, but obviously it would cost more money. So one of the things that we do is to then, rather than just sort of make an instantaneous image, just take a snapshot of the sky, we actually watch the object we're interested in as it rises in the east and moves right the way across the sky and sets in the west. And that fills in some of the gaps. That's the thing called Earth rotation aperture synthesis. It fills in some of the gaps. It basically changes the apparent spacing of each of these pairs of points, these pairs of telescopes, because, as the object's rising in the east, you're looking sort of side on at the array of telescopes on the ground. So they appear to be spaced differently than they are when the object's high in the sky or when it's setting in the west. And it changes the apparent angles as well. And that gives us more information on the distribution of brightness. In other words, it lets us create the image. So that's basically how we do it. Another question here from Matthew Sykes, who emailed in to ask about sounds from radio astronomy. So in Stargazing Live, we played the sound of a pulsar. That's basically a flashing object. So the radio signal's flashing and sort of getting stronger and fainter and stronger, brighter and fainter and brighter and fainter. What we can do is just turn that into a sound by taking the strength of the radio signal, basically would correspond to volume, and that would give us the sort of thud, 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 thud sound. Or in the case of the crab pulsar that we played, you get a thud, thud, thud that happens 30 times a second, so more like a sort of noise. Probably a good thing to do is to listen back to one of the Jodcasts that we did a while back now, back in 2008 in August. We did a whole interview about sounds from space, and I'll put the links to these Jodcasts on the website. A question from Dale Sanderson asks about how far away the objects are that we can see in the sky. And he basically says only a handful of objects visible to the unaided eye, in other words, without binoculars or a telescope, are located outside of our own galaxy. So he mentions the Andromeda Galaxy, which is the nearby Large Spiral Galaxy, about 2.5 million light years away. There's the Magellanic Clouds, which are two nearby dwarf galaxies visible from the Southern Hemisphere. But he's basically saying that he thinks the next closest spiral arms in our Milky Way are over 5,000 light years away in our Milky Way, and that's true. And therefore, he's asking, is it accurate to say that just about every object visible to the naked eye, without, in other words, not without using a binoculars or a telescope, is actually located not just within our Milky Way, but actually within the very local arm of our Milky Way that's sometimes called the local spur or the Orion spur? Well, it's actually true that many of the individual brightest stars are indeed closer than 5,000 light years. And there's a very nice schematic of the Milky Way that was produced from observations done with the Spitzer telescope that shows you sort of the approximate scales and distances to spiral arms. Turns out that one of the brightest stars in the sky, actually Deneb, which is in the Summer Triangle, is actually one of the more distant of these. It's about 3,000 light years away. But certainly the vast majority of the individually bright stars that you can see if you go out at night and look up at the sky are rather closer than this. But it's also true to say that you do see starlight from many stars that are farther away than this. And basically the glow of the Milky Way, so you see the sort of arching band of the Milky Way across the sky, that light is coming from stars that are much farther away than that. You can certainly see the bulge of the Milky Way with the naked eye when you look towards the centre of the Milky Way in Sagittarius. And that's basically stars that are maybe 20,000 light years away or more. So although you might not be able to particularly resolve them as individual objects, you are seeing the light from objects that are much farther than 5,000 light years away within our galaxy. And there are specific objects like Eta Carinae is a highly evolved star with its sort of circumstellar nebula. That's 9,000 light years away and that's visible. Omega Centauri is a globular cluster of stars 16,000 light years away, which is also visible. And in the northern hemisphere, there's another globular cluster called M13, which is just about visible to the naked eye in a dark sky, and that's 25,000 light years away. So they're groups of maybe a million stars, but they are visible just about to the naked eye. And in fact, there was a gamma ray burst, an exploding star at very large distances in the universe in 2008. The light from it basically takes about 8 billion years to get to us. And when that exploded, it was actually just about visible to the naked eye, even at that distance where the light's taken 8 billion years to reach us because it's such an intrinsically bright object, but it was only visible to the naked eye for about 30 seconds. So you'd have to have been pretty lucky to have spotted that flash of that object. But it's certainly possible to see some very distant objects with the naked eye without the aid of a telescope or binoculars. Okay, last question is from Johnny, who emailed in to ask about a very bright star rising low down in the southern horizon before dawn, which he correctly points out is Venus. It's actually not a star at all, it's a planet. But he was asking about a nearby object, a sort of companion star, which was nearby, which was rather dimmer, and he wanted to know what it was. I was having a look at what was there at the time when Johnny wrote in, which was actually before Christmas. It wasn't immediately obvious to me which star it could have been. It might have been Spica, which was near to Venus at that time, or it might even have been Saturn, which was also rising around the same time. But it doesn't quite fit what Johnny saw. So what I would suggest is downloading some software like Stellarium, for example, which is free. Which we mentioned quite often on the Jodcast, and that will tell you what's up in the sky at any time from any location on the planet, and that will help answer any of those questions. Or if you've got a mobile phone, one of the new smartphones, you might download one of these apps like Google Sky Maps, for example, which will show you the sky in any direction at the time you're looking at, and that might also be helpful in identifying objects.
Thanks for that, Tim, and that brings us to almost the end of the show. We just have to round up your feedback first. So on the email front, we've had a few emails. Randy Green from Bothell, Washington in the USA emailed us to tell us that the world isn't going to end in 2012. It's going to end in February 2011 when there's no intro or outro. So thanks for your comment, Randy. That's really sweet, but I'm pretty sure the world will continue.
We have to watch this space.
Yeah. We also had an email from Roger Malarkey from Kildare in Ireland, who has been burning the podcast to CD, which is really nice to know that people still listen to it on CD out there, because we do try to keep these shows to under 76 minutes so you can get all of one show onto a CD. Finally, we had an email from Andrew Walrond, who was worried that people will be missing out on the latest show because the front page isn't updating for him. So it was showing the October edition when there was a November and a December as well, and he had to go to the archive to find those. This is a problem we know about. It's something to do with the cache system, which I don't really understand, but Stuart has tried his hardest to make sure that browsers don't retain an old version and update it. You can get around it by doing a hard reload of your browser. Otherwise, if you subscribe to the RSS feed, then you won't have this problem.
Or just check out the archive.
Yes, or do what Andrew did and go to the archive.
On the forum this month, there's been so many comments, it's been hard to keep up with. But lots of positive comments. Please keep it up.
Thanks to all the birthday messages on Twitter. Thank you also to everyone who has tweeted or retweeted about the show, especially during the Stargazing live shows.
And on Facebook, Kimberly Goldstein, or Goldstein, says that she had listened to the December episode and describes it as really wonderful. These are the kind of comments we like. We also got a message on Facebook from Becky Rag Sykes, who is an archaeologist, but very keen on astronomy. Thank you for the message, Becky, and we hope to see you at Jodpub sometime in the future. Also, Jen likes dinosaurs.
I do like dinosaurs.
Little plastic dinosaurs.
And real dinosaurs.
But you don't have any of those in your office.
I'm pretty sure I don't anyway. So if you want to get in touch, you can do so via the website at www.jodcast.net.
On the forum at forum.jodcast.net.
Via Twitter at twitter.com/jodcast.
On Facebook at jodcast.net/facebook.
On YouTube at youtube.com/jodcast.
And on Flickr at flickr.com/groups/jodcast.
That's a lot of ways to get in touch.
That really is. And that brings us to the end of the show. So all that's left to say is a huge, massive, unbelievably big thank you to Professor Brian Cox, Dara O'Brien and Mark Thompson for being interviewed and for giving up half of their lunch hour to talk to us.
Almost the only free time they had in the day, I think, yeah, in between their scripting and their rehearsals.
A massive thank you also to the BBC Stargazing Live crew for actually allowing us to be on site. Also thank you to Tim for being the go-between between us and the people at Jodrell.
The editors for this episode were Adam Avison, Jen Gupta, Stuart Lowe and Tim O'Brien. That's all for this episode, so until next time.
Jod on.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.